He was dead before his face smashed into the pavement. "About fucking time," the Egyptian said. He rubbed his swelling face. The redhead reached a hand down and helped him to his feet. "I'll grab his shit," she said, wiping the bloody blade on the back of Dieter's tweed coat. She robbed him of his wallet, iWatch, iPhone, and a gold crucifix hanging around his neck. "Too bad," the woman said. "He is a beautiful man. Sehr schön. Let's get out of here." The man held one hand to his aching face. "Wait." She rolled Dieter onto his back with her booted foot and snapped photos of his lifeless face with her Galaxy phone. "Now we leave." The two of them sped quickly across the park, but not at a run, lest they draw attention to themselves. They climbed into a 2018 silver BMW 5 Series sedan and drove away, careful to obey the laws. The couple knew the Berlin Polizei would no doubt conclude that banker Dieter Hansmann had been killed during a robbery, far from any surveillance cameras and witnesses. When the police detectives learned he was actually a deep cover agent for the BKA, or Bundeskriminalamt, the German version of the FBI, they would know he was murdered, but not the reason why. Dieter Hansmann's corpse was proof of concept number 2. Chapter 7. Washington, D.C., the Oval Office. President Ryan sat in one of the new tufted leather chairs, his back to the resolute desk, his suit coat on the rack, tie loosened, and an iced coffee in hand. It had been a hell of a long day, and the news Arnie Van Dam was bringing was making it even longer. SecDef Burgess and SecState Adler sat on opposite Chesterfield couches while Arnie took the other chair across from the president. The rich caramel leather didn't swallow them up like the old sofas had. The round silver carpet with the bold presidential seal lay between them. "You can't blame her. The Senate is just 100 little presidents waiting to run," Adler said. "I don't fault her for her ambition, per se," Ryan said. He was still smarting from Senator Chadwick's unwarranted and vicious partisan attacks in the past few months. Vain and unscrupulous, Chadwick at least was a member of the opposing party. But ambition needs to have its limits. Everybody in the room knew that Ryan never asked for the presidency. A suicidal Japanese airline pilot was the reason he was first thrust into the Oval Office. "But she isn't president yet," Ryan said, "and I don't like the way she's trying to hijack my foreign policy agenda." "I just don't get why she did it," Burgess said. "We kept her in the loop the whole time." "Maybe we should have put her out front and center. She likes her picture in the papers," Adler said, "and Instagram Live. We offered her the opportunity to run point on this. She said she had other legislative priorities," Ryan said. "I took that to mean she wasn't interested, not hostile. Maybe she was telegraphing, and we missed it." "No way. I kept in touch with her office all the way through. Never a peep of concern," Arnie said. "And frankly, it's damn disloyal." Ryan couldn't help but smile. His chief of staff was as loyal as they came, a virtue he greatly appreciated, along with the fierce intelligence lingering behind his pale blue eyes. Loyalty? That's becoming as rare as honor in this town. "And shame took the 530 Greyhound out of here a long time ago," Adler said. "Something happened," Arnie said. "Like what?" Burgess asked. "Somebody yanked Dixon's leash." Arnie pulled a handkerchief from his pocket to wipe his wire-framed glasses. "Meaning?" Arnie fogged one of his lenses with his breath. "I think she's dirty." "Whoa, hold on there. That's quite a charge," Ryan said. Arnie tapped the side of his nose. "I'm telling you, I can smell it." "As beautiful as it is, I don't think we can call on your honker to testify in open court," Ryan said. "You have any proof?" "None. But common sense and 30 years up to my neck in this filthy swamp of a town has taught me a few things. She T-boned the shit out of us, the political equivalent of a hit and run. Why? What does she get out of it? Especially knowing what she's risking by crossing you." Ryan shook his head. I'm not a mafia boss, Arnie. I'm the chief executive, and I'm just trying to do what's right for this country and our national security. It's not like I'm going to put a hit out on her. He took a sip of his iced coffee. But I will promise you this. If she's committed any kind of crime or done anything to harm this nation, she'll answer for it. Arnie fought back a smile. He knew his boss and his friend as well as any man in Washington. There wasn't a vengeful bone in his body. For him, politics wasn't personal. But he had a profound sense of justice, and when anything threatened the things he loved most, he was ready to fight. President Ryan wouldn't sucker punch anyone, but he was one hell of a counter-striker. The SecDef shifted his weight on the leather sofa. I'm with Arnie. I can't for the life of me figure out what she gets out of killing this bill. The Poles are paying for the base and its maintenance. NATO gets a forward defense, and the Russians are kept back on their heels. A tangible, kinetic deterrent to further aggression. Cui bono, gentlemen, Ryan offered. The Georgetown Jesuit profs had drilled that into his skull early on. It always comes back to that. If we can't figure out what she gets out of it, let's figure out who else might benefit from her decision. Well, the Russians, certainly, Burgess said. They sure as hell don't want a U.S. armored division on their doorstep. I don't think the Russians are behind this play, Ryan said. No one has been more vocal in the Senate calling for stiffer Russian sanctions than Dixon. Who else? Come to think of it, the Germans didn't exactly come running to the table on this. We had to drag them by the elbows to get them to sign off, Burgess said. Nor the French, Adler added. If this makes NATO stronger, why would the French and Germans not want this? Arnie asked. He was focused on domestic issues and legislative affairs. He left the foreign policy heavy lifting to Ryan's cabinet. Because they don't want to piss Moscow off. The Germans especially are dependent on Russian natural gas, Adler said. But in truth, the total volume of trade between Russia, Germany, and France isn't significant. But it is there, Burgess said, despite all of the recent troubles with Russia. Nothing new on that account, Adler said. All through the Cold War, the Europeans were more than happy to have us spend billions running NATO while they traded heavily with the Soviets. I don't know if that made them hypocrites or us just plain fools. Why not both? Ryan offered with a mocking smile. And if, in the spirit of full disclosure, we use Russian RD-180 engines on our Atlas V heavy rocket, the SecDef said, one of the many infuriating, ironic compromises of the modern world. Ryan scowled. Signing the bill that exempted Russian rocket motors from the sanctions list had left a bad taste in his mouth, even though it was necessary at the time. We need to fix that, Arnie. Let's put that at the top of the Security Council agenda tomorrow. Done. Burgess asked, so if this isn't about European trade with Russia, why did the French and Germans resist this base treaty? To be fair, they resisted. But they eventually signed on, Adler said. But why the reluctance? My sense is that it wasn't about the base, it was about Poland. The bureaucrats in Brussels are far more worried about European nationalism than Russian expansion, and Poland is one of the most self-consciously nationalist countries in Europe. And the EU views nationalist movements as a threat to deepening European integration, Ryan said. Not just slowing integration down, but actually unraveling it. Brexit, the Italians, the Hungarians. The peasants are sharpening their pitchforks. And they saw a bilateral treaty between two NATO member nations as a threat to the borderless European Union? It was never expressed that way officially, but it was loud and clear in the European media, Adler said. There's always been a radical element that saw NATO as a barrier to European integration, especially since it so heavily relies on our participation and funding. SecDef Burgess chuckled. Last year, 6 out of 6 German diesel submarines were in dry dock, and they could only field 95 Leopard 2 tanks. The Russians have 20,000 tanks and IFVs active or in reserve. Bundeswehr helicopter pilots are borrowing civilian choppers to practice because the military ones aren't available, and only half of all French aircraft and a quarter of their helicopters are flying at any given time. And don't forget that incident a few years ago when the Germans used broomsticks for rifles on a training exercise because they had a shortage of the real ones. Adler shook his head. Neither Germany nor France nor half a dozen other NATO partners have lived up to their NATO spending obligations. We've been footing the bill since the beginning, even though the EU is our biggest trading competitor next to China. If you go to a party and people keep kicking you in the ass, you're probably the guy with the kick me sign pinned to his back, Adler said. So how do they expect to defend themselves against Russian aggression if NATO isn't ready? Arnie asked. You'd be surprised how many Europeans think it's American and NATO aggression that provokes Russian hostility. Get rid of NATO and your Russian problem is solved. More so they think, Ryan said. A few Americans think that too, Arnie added. So to bottom line this, you think Dixon is dancing to the tunes set by Berlin and Paris? Burgess asked. I think it's worse than that, Ryan said. Let's finish the exercise. Who else benefits from a canceled Polish army base? Maybe it's not about the Polish army base. Maybe it's really about us, Adler said. Ryan nodded, always the college professor. Agreed. Go on. And the list of people who stand to benefit at our expense is a mile long. And who would you say would be at the top of that list, besides the Russians? The Chinese, no question. Burgess said. Exactly. I'm sorry, Mr. President, I'm not following. How would China benefit from killing this deal? You want the short answer or the long one? Ryan grinned. I think you'd be disappointed if I didn't say both. The short answer is the BRI. And the BRI is? Arnie asked. Adler jumped in. The Belt and Road Initiative. It's China's comprehensive infrastructure plan to link two-thirds of the world's population and half of global GDP with new roads, rail, and shipping arteries stretching north-south from New Delhi to Murmansk and east-west from Shanghai to Lisbon. Think of it as a modernized version of the ancient Chinese Silk Road. Of course, the Chinese will kindly loan participating countries the billions of dollars those countries will need from mostly Chinese firms to come and build that infrastructure at usurious rates. Unlike us, who spend ourselves into oblivion giving stuff away, Arnie said. The president nodded grimly. It's the China dream, the means by which the Chinese communists plan on achieving global hegemony. How will cheap diapers and alarm clocks do that? Arnie asked. How much of your European history do you remember from college? Ryan asked. Not as much as the guy with the PhD in history who taught the subject at the Naval Academy, I suspect. The ancient Persians dreamed of an empire stretching from Asia to Europe, and they would have pulled it off, were it not for a few stubborn Greeks. Fast forward as far as you want to. Napoleon. Kaiser Wilhelm, Hitler, Stalin. They all tried it as well. Nothing would be more powerful or destabilizing than a united Eurasian landmass. It's Mackinder's heartland theory. Whoever rules Eurasia rules the world. American security policy for the last 100 years has been designed to keep that from happening. The Chinese certainly don't have the military means to do so. At least not yet, Burgess said. But they do have the economic means, Ryan said, and the will. What did Lenin say? A capitalist will sell you the rope to hang him with? BRI is a very clever and profitable way for China and Russia to unite against us, right under our noses, with most of the West European globalists cheering them on. Ryan leaned forward, and just maybe at least one U.S. senator. And so we're back to Dixon, Arnie said, right where you wanted us to be. Yes, I see it now, Adler said. Maybe not her directly, but her husband. What's his name? Aaron Gage, Ryan said, founder and CEO of Gage Capital Partners. His firm has made a lot of money doing business with the Chinese. He's made a lot of money doing business with everybody, Arnie said. He and Dixon are multimillionaires, thanks to him. You have a problem with millionaires, Arnie? Ryan asked with a smirk. He was a one percenter himself. Not with millionaires who earned it the old-fashioned way in the private sector before they got into politics, Arnie said. So we think she's fronting Chinese legislation to benefit her husband's firm, Burgess asked. She wouldn't be the first. This whole town stinks of legal nepotism, Ryan said. He was referring to the dozens of siblings, children, spouses, and other relatives who actively lobbied the Hill, though never their family members directly, in order to avoid the strict letter, if not the spirit, of the law. Money rules this town, Arnie said. The average senator needs to raise $14,000-$15,000 a day, every day they're in office, just to pay for their re-elections. This isn't just about campaign finance, Ryan said. It's about the whole damn system. The sweetheart contracts to family members, the revolving doors between elected offices and corporate boardrooms, the donations to family charitable trusts, lobbyists who become staffers, staffers who become lobbyists. I read the other day that nearly half of all ex-senators and nearly a third of ex-House members become registered lobbyists, and a whole bunch more of them aren't registered as such, but still work the cocktail circuit. It's all perfectly legal. But legal corruption is still corruption, especially when it's the lawmakers themselves who make this stuff legal. I hate it. And it's why Congress is becoming less functional every day. You can't expect the foxes who run the henhouse to rewrite the rules to protect the hens, boss, Adler said. Ryan dragged a hand through his hair, obviously frustrated. Another battle for another day, I suppose. He took his last sip of cold coffee, the ice tinkling in the bottom of the glass. I know you don't think much of my proboscis, but I still think we should look more closely at Dixon's family finances. Do you honestly believe a sitting U.S. senator is on the Chinese payroll? The SecDef asked. I won't use federal resources against an elected official without probable cause, Ryan said. Besides the fact it's not ethical, it's bad optics. How would it look to the country if I put FBI investigators on the trail of a likely presidential candidate I'm at odds with politically? Am I clear on this? Clear as rain, boss, Arnie said. His blue eyes smiled behind his glasses. But you don't mind if I ask around a little, do you? Chapter 8. Beijing, China. Chen Sheng hung up his phone. The traitor was dead. Such unfortunate news. As the head of the ultra-secretive International Counterterrorism Division of the Ministry of State Security, Chen was a man to be feared. But he was no fool. Facts were the best weapons in his line of work. The only thing his subordinates need fear was failure. Reporting bad news carried no penalties for the message bearer. From an intelligence perspective, the death of the treasonous physicist mattered little. Electric batons and ultraviolet ray shocks had already squeezed everything out of him they could. They had also overwhelmed an undetected heart condition. The scientist had no network to roll up, no family to exploit. Chen only wanted the scum to live longer so he could suffer more. Nothing was more delightful than to watch a sobbing prisoner concoct fantastical confessions in hopes of stopping torture that had no purpose other than the infliction of pain. What Chen had discovered was that the sniveling bastard had sold out his country in exchange for the promise of Canadian citizenship and a modest two-story home in a Vancouver suburb. The physicist's only mandate was to collect data as opportunity arose, paying the utmost attention to his personal safety. He worked in the quantum science satellite program at the University of Science and Technology in Hefei, passing along invaluable state secrets to the Canadian Assistant Trade Representative, a Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, operative. His Canadian handler made the mistake of agreeing to a CIA request for specific information regarding a recent test. To Chen's surprise, an unsolicited text from Chibi arrived on his encrypted phone, providing the CIA data request along with the physicist's name, address, and drop-off location, and a proposition. It was exceedingly rare for a foreign asset to walk in the front door with actionable intelligence. On the other hand, some of the greatest intelligence coups in history happened precisely this way. John Walker, the U.S. Navy Chief Warrant Officer Sailor, Aldrich Ames, the CIA operative, Jonathan Pollard, a civilian Navy intelligence analyst, and FBI agent Robert Hansen all came to mind. Of course, Chibi didn't walk into his office, literally. Rather, it was a brief digital introduction and actionable intelligence that proved highly valuable. But Chen found Chibi's proposition unpalatable. Under any other circumstance, Chen would have leaped at the opportunity to continue working with an intelligence goldmine like Chibi. But Chibi didn't want cash, at least not immediately, or honorifics, not even an exchange of intel. Chen detected no bitterness in this mysterious person, no ideological motivations for his actions. Ego? No question. Who would have the balls to reach out to the MSS and play such a dangerous game unless they had an inflated ego? Except, Chibi's ego wasn't inflated. He was as good as he thought he was. Chen's comrades in Bureau 7 were unable to identify or locate him through digital or other means, which suggested that Chibi had superb, if not insurmountable, OPSEC capabilities. Of course, this implied an equally capable offensive threat profile, his technical experts suggested. Prying into Chibi's whereabouts further could provoke a damaging counterattack, one that at the moment the MSS would be unable to defend against. But what to do? Accept Chibi's invitation to the auction? Or pass? Chen didn't believe in rogue intelligence operations. The resources required were too great for an independent organization, let alone an individual, no matter how gifted. Who would have reached out to him with such an unusual offer, other than another intelligence service? He couldn't imagine it was a Canadian operation. They wouldn't allow themselves to sacrifice one of their own assets under any circumstances, let alone in a proof-of-concept demonstration. Not only would it violate their own sentimental notions of so-called individual rights, but it would also discredit them in the eyes of future potential assets. Trust was the most important currency in the spy business, especially in the field. The Americans and other Western powers were equally unlikely candidates for the same reason. The Russians, as good as they were, didn't have this capability. Of this, he was certain. The same with the North Koreans, Iranians, and Indians. So, if not one of the competing intelligence services, then who? Chibi was a dangerous enigma and a loner, a single individual with the keys to the kingdom, as he'd put it in his proposition. And the name, Chibi, an obvious reference to the Battle of Chibi, a.k.a. Red Cliffs, a name as familiar to Chinese history students as Thermopylae or Agincourt was in the West. An 1,800-year-old battle personifying Sun Tzu's principle that all warfare was based on deception. A war that saw the smaller power overthrow the greater power. Chibi was a touchstone for all Chinese strategic thinking, both military and economic. Did that mean Chibi was actually Chinese? Impossible. Or was it? Despite the obvious draw, the offer of total access to Western intelligence sources, Chen declined the offer to attend the London auction for one simple reason. He hated enigmas, especially ones that could get him killed. Chapter 9. high over Monongahela National Forest, West Virginia. The CloudServe Bombardier Global 8000 business jet streaked across the night sky with its single passenger curled up in one of the luxurious leather seats, shoes off. Watson already had her first vodka tonic in hand as she reviewed her notes from the meeting with Foley. Her phone rang, a familiar ringtone. "How'd it go?" Elias Dom asked. He breathed heavily on the other end. "They hate the Cloud. They've fired us, and they're sending you to jail." "Ha-ha, funny. Seriously." "It would have gone a whole lot better if you had been there."
"I doubt it. You're the brains in this outfit. I'm just the pretty face."
"Yeah. That's why they kept asking, where's Elias? Did he go to Burning Man this year? When's the next rocket launch?" "I swear, sometimes I feel like I'm working for Mick Jagger."
"You know how it is. It's all about marketing." Wind buffeted Elias's phone.
"Yeah, but you actually have to have something to market," she wanted to say. "Foley really wanted you there. I think she's pissed."
"Yeah, well, screw her. I've got a lot going on, and no time to waste on circle-jerk meetings like that."
"Oh, but I do," Watson said to herself.
"What did she say about our war cloud bid?"
"That our bid is being considered just like all the others."
"God damn it. We need that contract."
Watson understood his frustration. The name of the game in tech was cash flow, and CloudServe needed some badly. She doesn't run the DOD. It isn't up to her. But she has her ear to the ground, and she sure as hell could pull a few strings on our behalf if she wanted to. She strikes me as a straight shooter. Then why in the hell am I paying an army of lobbyists to make this happen? That's your end of the business, not mine. But you might want to give her a call and reassure her a little.
About what?
She's nervous about her cloud security.
She has every reason to be if things go wrong.
Watson's temper flared, but she bit her tongue. I won't let that happen.
I know that. Believe me. I'm your biggest fan.
Watson let that one go, too. She waved her empty glass at the flight attendant, signaling for a refill. Watson frowned, more annoyed than concerned.
You okay? You sound like you're having a hard time breathing.
Yeah, sure. I'm fine. Marin County, California.
Elias stood on the manicured lawn of his seaside hilltop estate while he was speaking on his earbuds with Watson, 3,000 miles away. Broad-shouldered and movie star handsome, Elias was dressed in full kendo gear, black gi jacket, hakama trousers, body armor. He was still holding the bamboo stave Shinai practice sword in one hand while his sensei, an all-Japan kendo champion, smoked a Marlboro, waiting for the call to end so they could resume their practice. Elias absent-mindedly waved the sword in the air as he spoke. 2 dozen tiki torches flickered in a gusting ocean breeze rattling the ancient cypress trees. His bright, piercing eyes were nearly the same gray-green as the Pacific Ocean crashing on the rocks below.
"Anything else?" he asked.
"Less than 3 weeks until the Tech World Conference. You ready?"
"I was born ready."
"You can't just wing it, you know. You're giving the keynote speech."
"I'm working on it," Elias said, pointing his sword at his sensei. The Japanese swordsman nodded curtly and flicked his cigarette butt away before reaching for his sword and mask.
"Look, I gotta run, Amanda. Hey, take tomorrow off. You deserve it."
"I wish I could."
"Call me when you land so I know you're okay."
"I will. Thanks."
She rang off, a tinge of sadness and longing in her voice.
Exactly as Elias desired.
He forgot about her as soon as the call ended.
Elias grabbed his padded fighting gloves, peppering his sensei with 12 technical questions about Suburi in faultless Japanese as they both geared up. He couldn't wait for their next round to begin, each strike of his bamboo sword a blow against the mountain of worries looming over him.
Chapter 10. Alexandria, Virginia. Hendley Associates. Jack Ryan Jr. sat in his cubicle, staring at the Excel spreadsheet and scratching behind his ear, a nervous habit. It wasn't really itchy.
But ever since it had been nearly torn off that night in Afghanistan by the sticky bomb explosion and sewn back on with 9 stitches of catgut by an ISIS drug smuggler, Jack couldn't shake the feeling it was going to fall off. His finger kept gravitating to the stitch line, the same way his tongue would automatically float to the empty space where a tooth fell out when he was a kid. Or the way it did now, touching the capped tooth that had been chipped in the same explosion. He'd fully recovered from the aches, pains, and sprains of one of the hairiest ops he'd ever been on, grateful to be alive. He was even more grateful that Isabel Kashani was in his life again. Sort of. She was back in London with her family, partly recovering from their operation together in Afghanistan and Iran, and partly to figure out where she was with everything, including Jack. She had been working with the United Nations Office on Drug and Crime when he found her again in Afghanistan. But after everything that happened over there, she couldn't possibly return to either the land of her birth, Iran, or Afghanistan. "I just need some time, Jack," she'd said. And in truth, so did Jack. He thought she'd been married and had a kid. A clever cover he'd stumbled across on social media, and like an idiot, he'd swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. He figured he'd lost her forever. And now she was back. But neither of them was exactly sure what that meant or what the future held. Just one of the many reasons he was glad for the current assignment. Jack rubbed his tired face. It was getting late. The numbers swarmed on the screen like ants on a candy bar. He'd been staring at the electronic spreadsheet for hours, trying to puzzle out his company's Rubik's Cube of international bank accounts, wire transfers, and conflicting calendar dates against the data presented in the 10K annual filing. Something just wasn't adding up. Jack was a financial analyst with the Whiteside Hendley Associates, but also a field operative with the Blackside Campus. The campus was an off-the-books intelligence agency designed to carry out missions on behalf of the United States when traditional security agencies couldn't be called upon. But when Jack was back home, he was still responsible for helping Hendley Associates accomplish its mission as one of the world's premier private equity management firms. After all, it was the money Hendley Associates earned that paid the bills for all campus operations. Jack had started out as a financial analyst, and he loved the work, though if he had to choose between the two jobs, he would prefer being an operator for the campus. But in truth, he enjoyed the downtime as a financial analyst, using that part of his brain to decompress from the high adrenaline stress of close-quarters combat and large-caliber gunfights. In fact, he needed it. Jack had no problem carrying his share of the load on a mission. Thanks to John Clark's training, Jack liked to think he handled himself well in tactical situations, though there was still much more for him to learn, and he was proficient with small arms, CQB, and even knife fighting. But like his dad, Jack's mind was his best weapon. Jack ran a hand over his neatly trimmed beard absentmindedly as his eyes scanned the screen, searching for clues. He needed to crack this nut before he could move on with the project, an investment opportunity in Dubai that as of now was looking more and more like a shady deal. He and his dad shared a lot of qualities, but lately Jack had been taking stock. At just about his age, his father had already been medically discharged as a lieutenant from the Marines, married his mom, had 2 kids, earned a fortune as a trader at Merrill Lynch, completed a PhD in history, taught at the Naval Academy, and joined the CIA. If life was a race between him and his dad was lapping him badly. Heck, Jack felt like he was still stuck in the starting blocks. He pulled off his reading glasses and pinched the bridge of his nose, willing away the headache boiling up behind his blue eyes. His desk phone rang. Surprising, given the hour. It was Jerry Hendley, his boss. His dad had persuaded Jerry to found Hendley Associates and the campus years ago. "Hello, Jerry."
"Jack, I was wondering if you could spare a few moments."
"I'll be right up." Jerry Hendley, The former senator from South Carolina clapped Jack on his broad back as he stepped into the fourth floor office. He pointed him to one of the two chairs in front of his spotless desk and took the other one himself.
"Thanks for coming up, son," Hendley said in his honey-baked southern drawl. "I know you're on a deadline on that Dubai deal. How's that squaring up?"
"Dad always said when something looks too good to be true, it probably is. I just can't quite put my finger on it yet."
"I know you're as stubborn as your father, which is a virtue in this line of work. Coffee?"
"I'm fine, thanks. What can I do for you?"
Hendley's tailored shirt with French cuffs and diamond links was as immaculate as his mane of silver hair. The former senator was a shrewd financial expert in his own right, and Hendley Associates was one of the most profitable firms in its industry. But the ex-senator's passion was still national security. Like Jack's father, Hendley was an old-fashioned patriot, and unashamed to say so. More important, he was willing to back up his sentiment with something more than words. The 100 pre-signed presidential pardons sitting in his office safe were for the protection of his employees, not himself.
"I just had a long and interesting conversation with Arnie Van Dam. Did you hear about what happened on Dixon's committee today?"
"No, sorry, I've been buried in reports."
"I won't bore you with the details, but the long and the short of it is our shared concern that Senator Dixon might be playing ball for the Red Chinese."
Jack frowned.
"That's quite an accusation."
"More of a hunch, actually."
Jack nodded. If his father had actual proof, the woman would already be in jail awaiting trial, senator or not.
"She's probably not the only one. There's a lot of Chinese money floating around D.C. these days. But few are as powerful as Senator Deborah Dixon. If it's true, it's a real problem."
"How do I fit in?"
"I know your plate is full right now, and you've got a leave of absence coming up in a few days. But I'm asking you to put everything aside and take a look at Senator Dixon's financial situation."
Jack shifted in his chair. Finishing the Dubai project was a high priority for him, but his leave of absence was essential. He'd made a promise to Corey, and he was determined to keep it.
"We have a deep bench of financial analysts who are every bit as good or better than I am. Can't one of them take this on?"
Hendley flashed a wide smile. His perfectly aligned teeth sparkled with porcelain veneers. The effect was a cross between a kindly grandfather and a great white shark.
"You have a unique skill set in this regard, my boy. You have a doggedness to you that can't be taught, and more important, the political savvy to know when to tread lightly, if you catch my drift."
"In other words, snoop inside her sock drawers, but don't get caught doing it."
"Not even a whiff of suspicion, especially after the Chadwick fiasco. We need to keep as low a profile as possible."
Nobody in the Ryan family was particularly fond of Chadwick. Her irrationally unjustified personal animus toward the president had been expressed frequently in private and public venues until just recently. Her accusation that the president maintained a personal assassination squad was almost comically stupid and unbelievable to all but the most intractable Ryan haters. But it had struck perilously close to the truth. The campus was indeed a secret weapon available for rapid deployment by his father, to defend the national interest when normal security resources couldn't be used. The campus was only as effective as it was unknown. They needed to keep it that way.
Jack sighed, frustrated.
"Understood. I wouldn't ask you if it wasn't of the utmost importance, or if there was someone else I could trust with the assignment. And you know your father. He won't countenance the thought of deploying the FBI against an elected official without probable cause.
And it's up to me to find it."
"That about sums it up.
It just comes at a really bad time."
"So do most things that matter."
Jack nodded.
"Then I'd better get after it. Any ideas about where to start?" Senator Dixon won't leave any low-hanging fruit and sure as hell won't even come close to breaking any laws. If anything, I'd take a look at her husband, Aaron Gage. He's done a lot of business with the Chi-Coms over the years, and he's tied in with the Belt and Road Initiative. Chinese trade pushed through global infrastructure projects financed with Chinese money. Exactly. The senator's husband owns a private equity firm that invests heavily in infrastructure. I'd say that would be a good place to start. Jack stood. I'll get right on it.
Chapter 11. Washington, D.C. The elegant two-story Tudor-style home stood on a hill in leafy Kalorama Heights, bordering the park below. The sturdy hand-cut stone walls and antique wrought iron gate were more decorative than functional, but perfectly complemented the $5 million residence. Senator Dixon and her husband, Aaron Gage, relied instead upon the discreet services of a private contractor employing former Spec Ops personnel for 24/7 security. After their Guatemalan housekeeper cleared away the plates from a late dinner of Chilean sea bass and mint pea puree, Dixon poured fingers of Scotch rocks for both of them in the privacy of her husband's library.
Long day,
Dixon sighed as she fell back into the sofa. She plopped her bare feet on his legs and took a sip of her drink.
Must have gotten a little longer after Van Damme showed up, Gage said, chuckling, rubbing her feet with his powerful hands.
He was 16 years her senior, but the 72-year-old financial guru kept fit by submitting himself to a daily torture routine on his $15,000 ROM total body workout machine. He kept one in each of their several homes around the country. They first met when she was a freshly minted Wharton MBA and the vice president of marketing in a small firm his company had just acquired. Still smarting from a nasty divorce, Gage wasn't looking for a new relationship at the time. But Dixon was single, attractive, and whip-smart, and the chemistry between them was obvious from the start. They found they enjoyed each other as much in the boardroom as the bedroom, and from day one had formed an incredibly strong partnership that proved mutually beneficial.
You were smart not to get into politics, Dixon said over the top of her glass. Everything is politics, Gage said, driving his thumbs into her arches. Especially finance. I just get paid better. Anything you want to talk about?
He reached for his glass.
Arnie was pissed. I mean, really fired up. Which means Ryan is fired up. And that scares the hell out of me.
You? Scared? Since when?
Since I decided I wanted to be the next POTUS.
Ryan is a lame duck, and he has his share of enemies. We've talked about this.
But Ryan isn't distracted by retirement plans. He's laser-focused on his job, and I don't want to be his next target.
Why would you be? You've dotted your I's and crossed your T's. A dozen lawyers from the best firms here and overseas have signed off on everything. We're watertight and ironclad. Let Ryan rage against the night. What the fuck do we care?
Dixon took another sip. It's not me I'm worried about.
The silence hung in the air like a fog. Gage darkened, an old wound.
I wouldn't worry about Christopher. I didn't say anything about him.
You didn't have to. Gage gulped the rest of his scotch. After his divorce from his alcoholic ex-wife, Gage retained custody of his only son. Dixon understood that marrying Gage was a package deal, but being a stepmom taxed her nominal maternal instinct. The chore eased considerably after Christopher Gage was carted off to boarding school. Despite his high IQ and athletic promise, the young man had a penchant for bad decisions and worse friends, both of which got him expelled from several elite prep schools. Thanks to pricey attorneys and thick wads of cash, the troubled boy avoided well-deserved jail time. Seemingly scared straight after a near-death DUI incident in his freshman year in college, Christopher eventually graduated from Stanford Graduate School of Business with high honors. Within a decade, he had joined his father's firm,
Gage Capital Partners, and become the CEO of its public infrastructure and transportation subsidiary, Gage Group International. Currently, Christopher was operating in Poland with his own venture, Baltic General Services. But Dixon remained suspicious. The boy, a 38-year-old man, she had to remind herself, had too many close calls, and she had a long memory. But her husband, Aaron, had a short fuse. He was not a man to be crossed, not even by her. Dixon pulled her feet off her husband's lap, stood up, grabbed his glass, and headed for the bar. How's Poland shaping up? Christopher is doing a good job, still scouting things out, making connections. Dixon poured another drink for them both. He's a smart boy. I don't doubt he'll make you proud. She crossed back to the couch and handed him his glass. I just wish he'd settle down and get married. I'd like a grandson to play ball with while I still have my marbles. Maybe he'll find one of those beautiful, long-legged Polish girls. I'm sure he's looking as hard as he can. Gage chuckled, taking another sip. Like father, like son. I'm just asking him to be careful over there. I'm sure you understand my position. She smiled. Our position. Gage took another sip. He knows the lines he can't cross. Dixon remained standing over him. Even when the lines keep moving, she said over her glass. So long as we're the ones moving the lines, it shouldn't be a problem. Does he understand what's at stake? He's my son, isn't he? Thank God for that. Dixon smiled. Thanks for letting me vent. It's been a long day. She finished her drink. Trust me, Gage said, finishing his scotch. He's fine. He stood, yawning.
I'm off to bed. You?
I have some committee work to read, but I'll be up soon. Gage leaned over and kissed his wife on the cheek. Good night. He headed for the stairs leading toward their bedroom, making a mental note to call his son first thing in the morning, before it was too late. Chapter 12. San Francisco, California. The Carmen Red Porsche 911 Targa 4S slid into its designated $500 a month parking space in the basement of the glass and steel building near the Embarcadero. Lawrence Fung, a lean, handsome 30-year-old, dashed from his vehicle to the elevator, clutching his laptop case. He stabbed the up button furiously, willing the doors to open. He checked the time on the oversized Tag Heuer watch strapped to his narrow wrist. Shit. The doors finally opened, and the fast elevator whisked him to his expansive Bayview condo on the 13th floor. Fung punched the keypad on his keyless door, but the lock beeped. He cursed his clumsiness and punched the code again. The door clicked open, and he pushed his way through, kicking off his calf leather loafers and dropping the Porsche key fob into a sterling silver bowl on the hand-carved entryway desk, along with his polycarbonate slim wallet. Fung sped barefoot across the bamboo floor toward the kitchen, conscious of the precious few minutes remaining. He was starving, but there wasn't time to make anything, not even a cup of tea. He yanked open the Viking refrigerator and pulled out a bottled organic protein shake, cracked it open, and guzzled it before heading for his bedroom. He fell down into his chair just as his timer beeped, and powered up his desktop, ignoring the stunning view of the Bay Bridge lit in the low fog on the dark water below. He opened up Skype, scrolled down to his contacts list, and selected the video button. His face popped up in a small window on the screen. Not liking what he saw, he brushed his hair with his fingers and wiped his lips to make himself more presentable as the international phone line chirped and buzzed. An image popped up.
Sweetheart, Fung said, it's wonderful to see you.
A brooding, handsome face loomed on the wide monitor. Torre was mixed Korean, Haitian, and Irish. He broke into modeling on his exotic looks years ago as a teenager, but a vicious drug habit ruined his career. He was now in recovery. His ambitions turned elsewhere, convinced that modeling was a one-way ticket back into addiction hell.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
You look exhausted. Feng hid his frustration with the failing VOIP tech. Torre's lips weren't synced with his voice, like a bad kung fu movie, and his voice crackled and reverberated on the speakers. Bad connection. Miss you. Torre's brooding face softened. Miss you too. Feng's heart leaped in his chest. The face in the monitor was beyond handsome. Beautiful, really. He'd forgotten how much he missed Torre. Sunlight dappled the palm trees in the open sliding glass door behind his lover as the crashing ocean waves washed through the scratchy speakers. Thailand looks gorgeous. Torre sighed. Yes, I suppose it does. That terrible, huh? Feng chuckled, trying to lighten the mood. How's the city? Same. Busy, crowded, cold. More shit and needles on the streets than ever. Feng quickly added, can't wait to come visit you. Yeah, that would be great. Torre shifted in his chair, adjusting his sheer linen robe. Clearly, it wasn't. Something wrong? Some friends are leaving for a week's vacation to Tokyo tomorrow. Feng frowned with concern. They'll be back before you know it. I know. It just gets so boring around here sometimes. I hate to miss out on the fun. It can't be that expensive to go. I've already spent this month's allowance. Oh, wow. But no worries. But I know how it is. You've already done so much. That's putting it mildly, Feng thought. The cost of Torre's gender transition kept escalating. The hormone therapy was expensive, and the anticipated surgery even more so. Thailand performed more gender reassignment surgeries than any other country in the world, followed by, of all places, Iran, which viewed homosexuality as a Quranic evil. But rather than punish gay people, the revolution gave them the opportunity to change genders rather than suffer prison sentences. Given the choice between Thailand and Iran, Torre chose the Southeast Asian paradise. Both countries were cheaper alternatives to anything offered in the United States, where medical procedures alone added up to six figures. Unfortunately, Feng wasn't saving any money, because the lifestyle Torre insisted on maintaining in Thailand was more expensive than the medical bills themselves. You still have the credit card, right? Just use that. Are you sure? Absolutely. What's the point of denying yourself a little fun? I hated to ask, but thank you. You're just the best. Torre smiled shyly. It was quite charming. The hormone therapy was really taking effect now. He was completely androgynous at this point. Feng could only imagine the beautiful butterfly that would emerge from that delicious caramel cocoon over the next several months. With the ice between them finally thawed, Feng hoped the conversation might turn more interesting, even if only virtually. Feng's heart raced with anticipation. But before he could open his mouth, an encrypted text notice slid onto his monitor. Now what? Hey, babe, Feng said, staring at his phone screen. I gotta run. Something's come up. Maybe we can talk again tomorrow. I'll call you from Tokyo. But Feng had already hung up and was pulling up the text. Chapter 13. Why not? Chibi asked in the dialogue box. Feng's cursor flashed on his screen. What could he say? The truth, he supposed. I'm afraid. Of what? I know I'm being watched. She watches everybody. You know what I mean. She's been acting very suspicious, double-checking my logs. I understand. I would never want you to do anything that puts you at unnecessary risk. Feng sighed, relieved. He'd hoped the nature of this relationship would have changed over time. He didn't want it to end, though. It was too wrong not to be enjoyed. Thank you for understanding. Maybe next time, he typed. Sadly, there will not be a next time.
I need someone I can count on when it matters most to me.
Feng's stomach roiled with anxiety. He was losing Chibi. His thumb tore across the virtual keyboard on his phone.
Nobody can give you what I have.
But you won't give it to me anyway. So what does it matter? I didn't say I wouldn't. I just said I couldn't. Not now.
Why?
Because she is watching you. You do not even know if she is. You may never feel safe. You may never be able to help me again. I understand your concern, but I cannot wait around. Please don't play games with me. I hate that shit.
I am not playing games with you. I am your friend. But I have obligations to meet. If you do not want to help me, that is fine. We can still be friends. But you do not want me to get in trouble, do you?
What kind of trouble?
Now, who is the one playing games?
Feng cursed himself. He really was playing games. He knew there was a lot at stake. Had to be, with all of the money that had been tossed around. But he was genuinely afraid, too.
But the money. The damn money.
I'm sorry. You're right. I don't want to put you in a bad place. Do not worry about me. You already do so much for so many people. I do not want you to risk all of that. I will be fine. There are always other options. But no option as good as me. Let me do this one last time. I don't want to leave you hanging.
No, I do not think it is a good idea. Trust your instincts.
Please? I'm just having a bad day, that's all. Really, I want to do it.
But you said there is extra risk involved, right?
No more than usual.
I do not believe you. How about this? I can pay an extra 25K for this job. Would that help alleviate the risk?
Hell yeah. Feng couldn't believe it.
I wouldn't say no, smiley face. That's very generous of you. But only if you are sure. Do not let the money persuade you.
I'm not. I'm sure it won't be a problem.
Thank you. You are literally saving my life.
Glad to do it. Give me the details.
Chibi sent Feng the particulars.
Very doable, Feng decided. But precautions were in order. He was being watched. He could feel it. But he needed the money. And he needed this. Something secret. Something important.
The big fuck you to everyone around him. To everyone who doubted him. And he'd do anything to keep it.
Feng licked his lips. 25,000 extra would come in handy. He had a head for numbers, sure. But not money. Or at least, spending it. He was out of control and he knew it. The more he made, the more he spent. All the bills got paid, but only at the last minute.
Chibi knew this. It was why he had reached out to Feng. Feng was frightened at first. To have been watched, studied, probed. Kind of embarrassing, actually. He was a cybersecurity expert, a professional hacker, and he'd been hacked. That was a neat trick. Feng had been certain his personal financial information was secure, at least on his end. But Chibi must have hacked the losers at his bank and mortgage company, and who knows who else. His first instinct was to shut everything down, go dark, contact his boss, tell her what happened, humiliating as that would be, or maybe even call his friend at the FBI's cyber division. Another humiliation for sure, but maybe he would know a way to get out from under this asshole without losing his job. Either of those would have been the smart play. But something clicked inside him. Chibi could have robbed him blind or blackmailed him into service. But he did neither. He just wanted to talk. And they did. After the initial shock and embarrassment, Feng warmed to the idea of being known by this mysterious stranger. A stranger with a serious skill set. A master hacker who had reached out to him for help. No threats, just cash. And the thrill. Thrilling, because Chibi was most likely a Chinese agent. Possibly even with Unit 61398. Had to be. Those guys were the best. Feng was born in Alameda, California, an anchor baby by design. His mother had flown over from Guangzhou when she was 7 months pregnant. She took up residence with four other pregnant Chinese nationals at an illegal maternity hotel in a suburban residence owned by a Chinese expat maternity nurse charging exorbitant fees to her desperate countrymen and not reporting that income to federal authorities. The 14th Amendment to the American Constitution, not anticipating global jet travel, apparently determined that anyone physically born in the United States was automatically an American citizen, and tens of thousands of Chinese mothers had taken advantage of this quirky law over the last 20 years, including Feng's, who lied about her pregnancy status and the duration of her visit. Both lies rendered her entry status illegal. 2 months after he was born, she returned to the mainland. Within 2 years, she and her husband were allowed to immigrate to the United States with visas in hand, owing in part to Lawrence Feng's illegally contrived citizenship and sponsored by distant family members already living in California. The Fengs did well for themselves in their new country, at least initially. His mother was a civil engineer and his father an economist, and within a decade they had managed to climb the first few rungs of the American dream ladder. Lawrence was raised in a Mandarin-speaking home, and he quickly picked up Cantonese from his expat Hong Kong friends. His parents' social circles were limited to other Bay Area Chinese families, of which there were many. His parents taught him all of the myths and stories they had grown up on, including the ones that portrayed the Chinese Communist Party heroically, the vanguard of the revolution against Western imperialism. His mother and father didn't leave the red mainland for ideological reasons, but green ones. Dollar bills, to be exact. Outwardly and legally, Lawrence Feng was as American as apple pie, secretly listening to Alanis Morissette, Jay-Z, and Limp Bizkit, and smoking dope along with the rest of his non-Asian skater friends after school. But inwardly, he was Chinese to the core. Part of the great Han diaspora. Every year it became more and more obvious to him that the 21st century belonged to China, and no doubt, the centuries after that. In his heart, he'd always hoped his motherland would reach out to him. When Lawrence turned 16, he told his ultra-traditionalist parents he was gay. They disowned him. At 17, he left home. Technically, he was thrown out and entered the UC Berkeley mathematics program. Not easy for an Asian kid to do back then, with all of the admissions biases against Asians, who dominated GPAs, test scores, and extracurriculars relative to other ethnic groups. Cut off from his parents, he paid for everything along the way with student loans, including extensive international travel, a lavish lifestyle for him and his friends and paramours, top-of-the-line computer and audio equipment, and, best of all, cars. By the time Feng had finished graduate school, he was almost $300,000 in debt, and according to the law, none of those educational loans could be discharged through bankruptcy. One more reason to hate the U.S. government, as far as Feng was concerned. His pension for getting hired on at Silicon Valley unicorns that failed was a running joke among his so-called peers, who couldn't code their way out of a bento box. But he made enough quick cash to pay off all his debts and accelerate his already lavish lifestyle. Giving up his dream for a fast score with another startup, he finally relented and joined a boring but reputable firm 2 years ago, and began making seriously good and stable money for the first time in his life. Money he couldn't help but spend. Chibi knew all of this, and more. Feng didn't care. In fact, It was a relief, and deeply satisfying, an intimacy he shared with no one else in the world but this mysterious brother on the other side of the planet. Another dark and dangerous secret he kept from the people around him who thought they knew him. Only this time, he would never out himself, and neither would Chibi. What would be the advantage of doing so? Feng feared being discovered. The idea of going to jail terrified him. The idea of getting caught by his inferiors humiliated him. He knew the shame that would fall upon his parents would be unbearable for them, and for him. "I'll make it happen," Feng typed. "Thank you. Again." Chibi logged off. So did Feng. He'd saved his connection to his mysterious friend. But now, he was in deep shit, drowning in it. And for all of his bravado, he'd probably get caught. How in the hell would he pull this off? He wanted to call Tore and bare his soul. But his lover was so damned moody these days, and a bad internet connection only made things more frustratingly awkward. Even if he did pick up, what would he say to him? He had to keep Tore in the dark to protect him, just in case. Feng sighed. It didn't matter. His lot in life was to bear everyone else's burdens all by himself. He just had to accept it. Feng stood and shuffled toward his shower. The thought of pleasuring himself beneath the steaming twin rainheads crossed his